From WXXI News, this is Healthy Friday. I'm Elisa Orlando. Coming up on the program, a discussion of the Affordable Care Act and a chance to have some of your questions heard. Also today, we delve a little more deeply into the questions about depression, bipolar conditions, and suicide in the aftermath of the death of Robin Williams. First, though, if you show up at Rochester's Red Wings game tonight and you're one of the first 5,000 through the door, you'll get to be a superhero for the night. The Red Wings and Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield are handing out capes to draw attention to their new campaign about medications. The campaign features TAD, or Take As Directed, a Supermanish pill container who always does the right thing. And in this case, doing the right thing means getting the medication that you need in your system when and how you're supposed to get it in. Dr. Mona Chitri joins us in studio today to talk about the issue behind this baseball game stunt. That issue is medication adherence. And Dr. Chitri is the Chief Medical Officer and Vice President for Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield. Dr. Chitri, to go along with this awareness campaign and the event tonight at the baseball game, Excellus released a study earlier this week. WXXI's Carlette Claire reported that that study claimed a third of the people in upstate New York who have high cholesterol don't take their drugs. That the case?
That is the case. That is the case. These numbers that we studied and what we found was absolutely fascinating. We know locally, regionally, nationally, medication adherence is an issue. Is it concerning? Almost 50% of our patients with chronic conditions don't take their medications as prescribed. And as you mentioned, those with high cholesterol, up to a third. And that's a serious health concern.
So what made you look at medication adherence as a study? And quite frankly, I don't really see this in research literature too much. It doesn't seem like there's a lot out there that looks at this. What made you pick it up?
So actually, medication non-adherence has been considered the hidden epidemic. We have great medications. We have great ways to diagnose disease. But unfortunately, we're not optimizing a member or a patient's quality of life. So we, in the medical literature, have been talking about adherence and how to optimize adherence for years. But we thought, we thought that we can really raise awareness in a different way through our campaign and our white paper or fact sheet that we just released.
The white paper and the fact sheet talk about other kinds of issues. High cholesterol was one we just discussed, depression, diabetes. Are these the main places where people are not taking their meds, or are they just the most common conditions?
Yeah, those were the four conditions we studied. We studied high cholesterol, high blood pressure, depression, and diabetes. However, this issue of non-adherence really spans all conditions. Bipolar disease, I know you're talking about that later today. Pain medication, you name it, it is a issue across the spectrum of medications.
Okay, so it stands to reason that if I go to the doctor and I get a diagnosis and I go to the extent of filling the prescription, and we can talk about where that falls into this whole picture, it seems like common sense that I would just take the medication. So what are the reasons? I know that in her story, Carlette outlined a few of the barriers that people have to taking medications, but why don't you review them?
Sure. So the one thing to note is there is no one simple factor for any individual person. We need to meet every patient where they are and address their individual barriers. But we know there's like the top five. The first is forgetfulness, just not remembering to take their medication on any given day, or if it's a twice a day or three times a day medication, clearly that is more complex. The second is cost. Cost is an issue, especially with some of the newer brand name medications and specialty drugs coming to market. Luckily, for most chronic conditions, the depression, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, we now have generics available. Those are low cost, and those are great options for our patients. Some patients have trouble getting to the pharmacy. So just transportation, mail order, we believe is an option for them. And a very, I'll put these two pieces together. Fear of side effects and fear of drug interactions are very, very concerning to our patients as well. So definitely talk to your pharmacist, talk to your doctor, so that we can resolve any barriers, questions you have.
All right, let's talk about let's talk about that in terms of talking to your pharmacist or talking to your doctor about side effects. Do people go into these diagnoses and get these medications prescribed without understanding all the facts? I mean, if I walk out of my doctor's office with a prescription, is that where I leave it until I go to fill it and I either can't afford it or then I start to worry about it?
So I think what we'd like to do is we'd like to have patients have the conversation with their doctor. But sometimes, you know, you're in a rush, you have things going on, it may not come up. So absolutely, they should then have the conversation with their pharmacist. So usually what happens, and this is unfortunate, but we, about 15% of patients, 12 to 15% of patients don't even fill that first script that the doctor gave them. So we lose patients right there, you know, as they're walking out of the doctor's office, leave it in their purse and then just decide, you know, I don't need this medication for whatever reason. And then we lose patients over time. Some patients don't feel like they even need the medication anymore. And it just, over time, 50% of our patients, our community, doesn't take their medications as prescribed. And again, there's serious health consequences to that.
All right, let's talk about the health consequences. I think that they may seem obvious, but let's start there because there's a lot in this report about cost. But what I want to understand better for our listeners is if you don't take medications, what can happen?
Right. So I often think of cost as secondary. So for me, taking your medications is going to give you the quality of life you deserve. It is going to get your chronic condition under control. It's going to allow you to optimize life and allow you to do the things you want to do. So for me, that is the number one opportunity for our region so that we can have a great quality of life. So what are some of the other consequences of not taking your medications? The first thing is you're often prescribed more medications. So if you have diabetes and you're still not under control, your doctor will probably add another medication to your regimen. Then there's a chance you'll need more doctor visits. There's a chance of higher rates of hospitalizations, primarily because these silent conditions have significant risks such as stroke, such as heart attack, such as amputation, et cetera, higher risk of skilled nursing facility needs. So there are so many downstream effects of not taking your medication as prescribed.
All right, let's talk about who some of these people are. I'm looking at a study from the World Health Organization that talks about 50% of patients typically take their medicines as prescribed. Are there certain sociodemographic features, or are there certain types of people, or are the older people, younger people that don't adhere?
So this is a great question. And actually, medication non-adherence does not really have any biases. Gender, race, age, socioeconomic class, we have challenges across all of those populations.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so what is it about medication?
You know, I think it depends on the patient. So one patient I used to treat had a fracture and had osteoporosis. And, you know, we would have all these conversations of the importance of taking your medication so you don't have another fracture. Her reason for not wanting to take her medication was she didn't like the spokesperson who was on the TV ad. Another person can be very worried about side effects because their neighbor had side effects. One person simply forgets because, oh my gosh, you know, I forgot to get to the pharmacy this month. The barriers are vast, they're varied, and patient specific. But I know that if we can increase awareness and start having the dialogue between healthcare professionals and patients or our community, we can improve our rates. I know we can.
Well, okay. So let's talk about that dialogue. It's not, I bet my primary care physician would say, it's not my job to call you and tell you to take your drugs. Is that accurate?
Right. So what we're trying, well, I would say all of us in healthcare have to work together, every single one of us. So the primary care provider is busy. We're all busy, but how can we spur the conversation of the importance of medications? And then that conversation has to be reinforced by the pharmacist, who can also talk to you. And you should be very open of having any questions you have answered by that pharmacist. And then we have the caregiver. How important is it for your family member to remind you to take your medication and keep you healthy? So the goal with our campaign, especially with TAD, is to raise community awareness. We all in the healthcare spectrum have to tackle this together. It's not just one physician or one pharmacist. It's all of us.
I was interested to hear you say a little earlier that pain medication is one of the things that sometimes people don't take. It would seem to me if something presents itself right there in your body that you would want to solve that problem, whereas other things like diabetes mm-hmm. or things you can't feel or see might lend themselves to non-adherence a little bit more.
I agree with you. So those silent conditions a higher rate of non-adherence. But believe it or not, some people who have true pain, there's a fear of addiction. And that sometimes is a barrier for patients to be under full pain control.
And sometimes there's a reason, right? Some medications do have addictive
absolutely
features, right?
They absolutely do. They absolutely do.
All right. So you've talked about things like disease progression, you know, the fact that if people don't take their medications, they can get sicker. They might have more problems or more medications to take. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the cost. You're really focusing, Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield has focused on this as a cost issue. What are you looking at in terms of numbers?
So I would say we're looking at it as both a cost and quality issue. So quality is one of our, you know, we want to keep our communities healthy. From a cost perspective, in upstate New York, when we focused on those four chronic conditions, we found the opportunity to be almost $2 billion of excess medical cost because of noncompliance and non-adherence. And again, that's related to the hospitalizations and to the nursing facility visits and to the complications of those conditions. So staggering numbers, both financially and from a quality of life perspective.
All right. Let's talk about the people that do take their medications. Are they really that much better off?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you have a chronic condition, besides diet and lifestyle, the next step of managing that condition is taking your medications as prescribed. So studies have shown those that take their medications as prescribed do have better outcomes.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about what you are trying to do about this. You're obviously working with a public awareness campaign, TAD, the pill container. You're going to do this thing at the Red Wings game tonight. Why don't you explain what that is? You're actually not just handing out capes. You want people to use those capes, right?
Absolutely. We are looking to create a new world record. Most people wearing a cape doing the wave. And at the end of the day, our goal is to raise awareness. How do we raise awareness? You know, let's make it fun. Let's make medications fun. Let's talk about chronic conditions in a fun, positive way so that maybe it sticks. So we have a community awareness campaign, TAD, our superhero pill bottle. And actually, TAD has a belt. And on that belt, and you can go to our website to find this, we talk about some of the common barriers in his belt. And what are the barriers and how can we help support our community in addressing those barriers?
I wonder if you could talk about the aging population. The aging population is growing. The U.S. Census Bureau mm-hmm. predicts increases in the aging population. And I assume it's not just forgetfulness that causes problems with medication adherence. But what do you see in the future in terms of drugs and older people and this issue that you're discussing?
Right. It's very important. Obviously, some of the same issues apply for forgetfulness is one, but side effects and drug interactions as we age, we are often, you know, our bodies change and often we're put on other and more medications. So I would especially encourage our older population to have the conversations with their pharmacists, with their physicians about all of the medications they're on, any herbal supplements, dietary supplements, vitamins, so that you can get a really full picture of the medication regimen and we can make sure we're optimizing and reducing your side effects and or drug interaction risk.
Okay. Some of the outreach that you're doing involves obviously the general public, but are you also doing outreach to places like pharmacists, caregivers, wherever people are interacting with the healthcare system, since you said it was a very multifactorial issue?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have what we consider a three-pronged approach. The first is our community awareness campaign, and that's really just to raise awareness on the issue. But then what we're also doing is working with pharmacists, case managers from the health plan, physicians, our hospital systems, and we are utilizing, you know, our claims data. So we're looking at who's adherent, who's non-adherent, and how can we all work together to get our patients back on track. So absolutely using our data. And then we're also doing some grassroots initiatives where we're working with various groups such as Trillium Healthcare versus church groups, Pathstone, where in those communities we can help to educate and empower about chronic disease, but also the importance of medications.
All right, you're listening to Healthy Friday on WXXI and in the Finger Lakes on Public Radio. I'm Alisa Orlando, and we're talking today with Dr. Mona Chitri. She's the Chief Pharmacy Officer and Vice President for Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield. We're talking about medication adherence today, or non-adherence, as the case may be. Many of us do not take our medications as prescribed, and Excellus is doing some outreach and an awareness campaign to try and get people to take as directed. They're calling it TAD, and their superhero character is called TAD, Take As Directed. One of the things that is recommended by at least some of those who study this issue are things like public-private partnerships. You just talked about outreach to community agencies. I also wonder if you're doing any kind of partnering with technology or how you think technology is going to affect this. It would seem to me that electronic reminders or electronic medical record could be helpful.
Absolutely. So, again, trying to find our community where they are, each individual patient. For some patients, those pill boxes still work. So advocating for pill boxes, absolutely still an option. We have pharmacists who call patients, and those are nice monthly reminder systems that their medications are now due. But now the new wave is apps and mobile devices and utilizing that newer wave of technology that can actually remind a person every day, you know, at 8 a.m. or 8 p.m. So we have some apps that we're recommending that are free for the community should they shoot. Should that help them?
So you said the pillbox works in some cases.
Yeah.
Some of us like technology. Are there one or two things that we can do as patients to make sure that we do take our medications? It doesn't seem like it's an easy answer.
It's not an easy answer. So I would say the first thing is make sure you know why. So the key to success in healthcare is to be educated, to be your own advocate. So for me, I would suggest know why you're taking your medication, know your chronic condition, and know the value that medication has for you. Make sure you get all of your questions answered so that you feel comfortable taking the regimen that has been prescribed to you. So the first thing I would say is be educated, and then the second thing is be empowered. And our goal is to empower our community. Empowerment meaning, do you have any barriers? Are you still, are there transportation issues to get to the pharmacy, cost issues? And if we can empower you to know those barriers, we can find some resolutions and help you solve them.
So even if you can overcome those barriers, or you think you can on your own, medication can be confusing. Even if I want to take it every day, look at the bottle. The language is different from medication to medication. It's very difficult to understand. I mean, how do you feel about sort of common terminology? Some organizations, the National Council on Patient Information, really want some standard language to be agreed upon so that you don't have to sort of translate for yourself as a patient.
It's very challenging. I agree. We have patients that are commonly on, you know, 5-6 different medications, all being given at different times of the day, with food, without food. So I agree, any way we can simplify the regimen and simplify the directions, that would be helpful. I would advocate having a conversation with your pharmacist and physician about that, because there are some state laws and state mandates that we're still working through to get to that simplification.
Do you think doctors are going to take kindly to the idea of me as a patient saying, you know, could we work this so it's fewer medications, or could we make it easier for me? I mean, I'm not sure physicians would be open to that, or the healthcare system in general would be open to me having a say in how we're going to do this.
Well, I think ultimately all of us in the healthcare field want you to have a great outcome. And my job, or a physician's job, will be easier and we'll get to our mutual goal quicker if you have an active part in your health. So I'm not sure. You know, I'd like to think that our healthcare practitioners would be very open to that conversation. And I also, you know, that would be your pharmacist as well as your physicians. I think they'd be open to that conversation.
All right. You do see some of the research talks about low health literacy and the issues around medications with people who have low health literacy. In some cases, this is about not being able to read generally, but in other cases, it's about not really understanding whether there's a language barrier or whether it's just not understanding the health language. How do you intend to approach these populations?
Yeah, so that's an additional challenge that we have. So where we are beginning is we're beginning where they are. We have had lots of the healthcare community nationally has been trying to tackle medication adherence since the beginning of medications. You know, we actually have quotes from Hippocrates saying that people don't take their medications back in, I think, 600 BC. So we need to think of something creative and we need to be different. So what we're trying to do with these groups with low literacy, low health, limited health access, we want to meet them where they are. And that's where our community partnerships really come into place. So how can we work with the churches and the housing communities, educate them so they within their peer groups can educate each other? So how can we provide tools to those populations? And that's where we're starting. We're starting with some tools that within the population they can use. And we'll see how that goes.
You've been looking at this issue for a long time. The healthcare industry has been looking at this issue for decades. Have you in your work seen any changes at all? Any changes in what these numbers look like? Or is anything moving in a particular direction? Or has it been a problem that has always been there and has always stayed pretty much the same?
So it's a problem that's always been there. For as long as I have looked at the literature, that number is hovering around 50% of patients not taking their medications as prescribed. But what I am happy to report is when we launched TAD in February of this year, 2014. And before we launched TAD, we did a survey of Monroe County, adults in Monroe County, and asked them simply, are you aware of the term adherence? And at the time, the awareness of this term was only 3%, very, very low. After we launched TAD, 6 weeks after we launched TAD, we did another survey. And we're very happy to report that the number of Monroe County adults who have actually now heard the term adherence and understand what it means is up to 15%. So still, we have a long, long way to go. But from these surveys, I think we're making progress.
All right. Let's talk. I'm going to hear from listeners if I don't mention this. And that is that there are people who feel that they want to do something before they get to the medication stage. Either they want to try something of like a more natural remedy, or they want to try and change lifestyle to bring cholesterol down or to work with their condition. And sometimes physicians will say, all right, but we're going to prescribe the medication anyway. In other words, the medication is prescribed, and people just don't want to go that route yet. They're not ready to go that route yet. How do they figure into these numbers on non-adherence? And what do you say to them? Do you say to them, just take your medication? Or it just seems to me that if they're not going to work with the physician on that one point, how will they affect these numbers?
So those members are included in these numbers. And I've been there. I've worked with patients who've said, I want to try another 2 months of diet and lifestyle. I want to try a month of, you know, not eating cake at night. So we need to all work together and let's set some reasonable goals. So absolutely, diet and lifestyle are the number one ways to manage some of these conditions, but we have to set reasonable goals. So let's give it 3 months. And if in 3 months we both agree that if we're not at goal, we're going to start medication, then we need to adhere to what we've both agreed on. So if a patient or someone feels that they want to try, you know, doing it on their own first, I think that's great. I think we should empower them and support them and give them the tools to get to their goal on their own. But we have to set reasonable timelines because these silent conditions are affecting your body since diagnosis. So we need to get these conditions under control.
So, but just to be clear, what your study is looking at, though, is adherence based on prescriptions written, not based on what we maybe thought that we needed as patients. So you take mm-hmm. what prescriptions were written, and that's how you base adherence.
Correct. Prescriptions that were written that were either not picked up or then not taken as directed.
All right. So you're working with this for the long term, correct? The outreach that you're doing now, is it a specific project that's in place, or do you just intend to keep on doing it in terms of public awareness and in terms of outreach to community?
Right. So our goal is to be in this for the long haul. Our goal is to be a national leader in one of the healthiest communities in America, that we have all achieved a higher rate of quality of life and medication adherence. And, you know, we'll work with the various community groups. We'll work with other health systems to get us to where we need to be. But that's going to take time. And we know that. It's not going to be one big campaign and we're done. We're in this for the long haul.
I can imagine, too, that you have to look at the variety of conditions. You alluded to this, but the incidence of non-adherence must really vary sharply by condition. Is that the case?
It does. And all of those conditions have unique barriers. But we'll start with the chronic, the big chronic conditions, and we'll kind of make our way down from there. And one of the things that our study shows and literature shows is just continual reminders. So 1 year after diagnosis and 1 year after being diagnosed with diabetes, we still need to remember to take our medications. So there's a lot of repetitive education that we'll be planning on doing.
In other words, we might be great in the beginning,
yes,
but then over time we kind of lose it a little bit. We lose the ability a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you see health coaches playing a role here? There's a lot now about you know, value-based care and the role of these health care sort of coordinators. How will they play into this?
Yes, I think every stakeholder will have a role. Health coaches, nurses, social workers, pharmacists, physicians, we can all address a unique barrier to what a patient may have. And at the end of the day, all of us should be able to work with each other to get to a patient where they need to be.
All right. The event takes place tonight at the Rochester Red Wings baseball game in Rochester. The first 5,000 people will get a cape. And the goal is that everybody will do the wave in the third inning, correct?
That's right. It'll be fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun. Yeah. And they're trying to break a world's record in terms of people doing the wave, all to draw attention to the problem of taking your medications as prescribed. Thank you very much, Dr. Mona Chitri, for your time.
Thank you so much.
From Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield. And thank you for listening to Healthy Friday. When we return, we'll talk about why Robin Williams' depression was perhaps hiding in plain sight. First, though, a short break from member-supported public radio. A reminder that this program offers medical information, not medical advice. If you have a health care concern, please be sure and see your health care provider or your primary care physician. You're listening to Healthy Friday on Public Radio, AM 1370, FM 89.5, and FM HD2 91.5, Public Radio in the Finger Lakes.
Coming up in our second hour, the Democrat and Chronicle has moved into the future with really multimedia coverage of events. It's not just an article in the next day's paper. We're going to hear from one of their reporters who covered the aftermath of the Puerto Rican festival as a great example of how the newspaper has moved into the modern era. We're also going to talk about how you value an NFL franchise. How do they figure out what the Bills are worth? We'll find out next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Exodus to Jazz, presenting Tom Harrell's Colors of a Dream Sextet featuring Esperanza Spalding with Jonathan Blake and Jaleel Shaw, Saturday, August 23rd at Hochstein School of Music at 8 p.m. Details at exodustojazz.com.
Welcome back to Healthy Friday. I'm Elisa Orlando. Coming up in the next hour, Matthew Leonard and Michelle Faust will be here from the WXXI newsroom. They'll be talking about the Affordable Care Act and helping to answer some of your questions about it. First, though, more ideas, thoughts, context, and discussion about the health issues that came to light this week when comedian and film actor Robin Williams took his own life. Williams' death has raised a lot of questions. We heard this question in particular raised in the media this week. How could someone with so much going for him possibly feel depressed to the point of suicide? The idea that money, fame, the life that celebrities have, couldn't those things have helped them feel better? And to help us answer these questions, we're talking on the phone today with Dr. Adrian Leibovich, the chief of psychiatry at Rochester General Health System. Dr. Leibovich, there's the question of how could someone with so much presumably to live for take his own life? And then there's another question. How could a comedian, and generally speaking, a comedian who is a pretty genuine person, not overly dark or sarcastic, how could somebody who seems to be having so much fun all the time be depressed? Those are big questions.
Yes, it just brings up the fact that mental illness doesn't spare anybody. We associate especially depression with situations in life where people are unhappy, where they struggle with different stressors, but the reality of it is that There is such thing as a mental illness caused by chemical changes in the brain, as such, you see everybody from all walks of life and of any level of achievement or socioeconomic status being affected by mental illness, and it is possible that Robin Williams' death illustrates just that.
We've heard a lot, obviously a lot of outpouring of compassion and sympathy for Robin Williams and for his family over this past week, but we've also we also have heard a lot about the fact that he had been struggling with both depression and addiction over the course of his life. He talked pretty openly about this recently, about relapses and such. How much do these two conditions go hand in hand, addiction and depression? And is it a chicken and the egg, or is there any way to say in any particular person how one condition starts and the other one picks up?
It's a good question. First of all, I'm talking as someone who knows Robin Williams the same as everybody else who is not in his inner circle. So I was personally affected because it's someone I liked very much, and the considerations are speculative that way. But simply watching him over the years and seeing his unusually high level of energy displayed in publicly, it makes you think that someone like him may have suffered with a mood disorder called bipolar illness, that involves both periods of high, for which we know him, but also periods of severe depression, both the highs and the lows of bipolar illness are associated with an increase in the likelihood of drinking to excess and using recreational drugs. There is a significant overlap between substance abuse and addiction and mood disorders in general, and especially bipolar illness.
Well, let's define our terms to begin with.
Right.
You just mentioned bipolar, and that term has come up a lot around this. But let's define depression first. Can you define depression for me, and then talk to me about bipolar as an aspect or a type of depression, if that's what it is?
Yeah. So depression is anything from a human emotion. Doesn't spare anybody. Everybody has felt depressed sometimes. But from a clinical point of view, depression is an illness. And the two cardinal features of depression are, number one, low mood, feeling down in the dumps, feeling blue. People refer to it in many ways. And number two, a loss of ability to experience pleasure and interest in things that were pleasurable and interesting before becoming depressed. We have a name for this, anhedonia. One of these two signs are sufficient to warrant a diagnosis of clinical depression if persistent enough and severe enough. On top of it, there are many other symptoms, including problem sleeping, problem eating, problems with concentration, pessimism, a certain outlook on life when one sees mostly the empty half of the glass. And in extreme forms, depression can lead to changes in how one thinks and loss of touch with reality, a sense of severe emotional pain, and ultimately a sense that life is not worth living.
So, staying on the idea of depression for a moment, we understand it's not a minor trivial concern, but everybody gets depressed now and again, don't they? Is it very much different from the sense of feeling down in the dumps over a loss, or I'm having a really bad day or a tough time right now?
I think you can think of it as a spectrum. There are situations situations where someone feels depressed for brief periods of time or even for longer periods of time, but the intensity of the problem is low enough that it allows them to continue to function. And then there are degrees of severity that add so much suffering that the person becomes disabled. So yeah, it's a universal emotion. It's a common illness, and not infrequently the illness is severe enough to warrant and require treatment or warrant hospitalization or put someone's life in jeopardy.
All right, we're talking with Dr. Adrian Leibovich, the Chief of Psychiatry at Rochester General Health System, today on Healthy Friday. Dr. Leibovich, when we've seen the reports about Robin Williams this week in the media, it was almost immediate that they talked about depression, and then almost directly after that, that the media reports discussed bipolar. You've mentioned it a little bit. So define that for us and describe why it is that we may have assigned that to Robin Williams, even though we don't know that that was his condition.
Yes. The bipolar illness is a disorder of the brain consisting of problems with modulating mood. In general, we tend to be sad if something bad happens to us. We tend to be happy when something good happens to us, and we respond in a proportional manner to the circumstances in our lives. That would be a normal change of mood consistent with circumstances. In bipolar illness, this ability is lost, and without a particular precipitant or a serious enough precipitant, people can become unusually happy or unusually unhappy, unusually energized or unusually slowed. Because of that, bipolar illness is characterized by a sequence of periods of depression and periods of high, also periods when everything is normal in between. When someone has a depression, part of bipolar illness, that depression is indistinguishable from the depressions people have who do not have bipolar illness. So that's why in Robin Williams's case, people talked about depression because they presumed the suicide was around the time when he was depressed. And at the same time, they talk about bipolar illness because at least his public persona shows him many, many times being extremely energized, excited, speaking extremely fast, showing many of the features that are also characterizing a high in bipolar illness, which we call a manic episode.
I want to talk a little bit about treatment and resources for people who have these conditions, but I still want to stay on the topic of terms for a moment, because the clinical condition called depression, I was reading a blog earlier today that said that this person who was writing said that the word depression could really use a different name, because the word depressed is so often used to describe people who are a little bit down, and we tend to use the term bipolar, I think, too, or bipolar disorder. These seem to me to be very accessible medical terms, unlike other kinds of medical terms. And I wonder if you feel that contributes to our lack of understanding, or do you think it makes us more aware of the problems of people with these conditions?
I agree that the word depression has become so generic that it fails to characterize the seriousness of a particular situation. It also has merit, though, because it educates people. It makes the condition more acceptable. It makes it more acceptable to talk about it. The way the medical community deals with the fact that there is depression as a feeling and then there is depression as illness, we specify clinical depression, which implies that this is an illness. It's not a general upset and so forth. But you cannot expect the evade the reality that this is a continuum, and you have a number of people who experience depression who might not need treatment, and then as it gets more and more severe, it becomes more disabling, and it requires some intervention, some of which is medical.
Perhaps because there are not readily apparent physical symptoms in the way that we think of traditional health symptoms, there's a sense that that there's a societal element to depression and to bipolar and to mental illness in general, perhaps. Do you agree with that? What role does community and society play, if any, or is this strictly a medical diagnosis? I think there's some controversy about that question.
I think that when it comes to what I call unipolar depression, depression outside the scope of bipolar illness, it is true that there are societal factors causing depression. Personal experience lead to depression. Bad things happen to people, and sometimes they are so bad that they overcome someone's usual ability to cope, or there are people whose coping ability is very low and are more vulnerable. So you have this what we call reactive depressions, where psychosocial factors play the major role. There are depressions that are the result of a chemical vulnerability, if you want, in the brain, though. When it comes to bipolar illness, while societal factors can influence the timing of an worsening of symptoms, for instance, the cause is always a biological cause.
We almost throw away the term chemical condition or chemical imbalance when we talk about a depression that's not bipolar. But what are you saying about these factors? When you say people, if they lose an ability to cope because they're particularly vulnerable, what are they vulnerable to? Is it a chemical imbalance that happens after they are unable to cope, or is this something else? Is there not always a chemical imbalance involved?
There are situations where there is no chemical balance involved, where the depression is the clear result of a set of circumstances that overwhelm someone's ability to cope. We call those reactive depressions, adjustment reactions. With depressed mood, we have different terminology for that. It is also true, and there is science to back this up, that in extreme cases where what fuels depression, even if it's a psychosocial factor, is severe enough and lasts long enough, that the brain eventually starts responding in its biochemical activity, and the distinction between a reactive depression and a biological depression gets blurred. In practical terms, from the point of view of how we approach treating someone with depression, we do not dwell too much making very clear distinctions between what caused depression. Depression is a common pathway, and we try to address everything, both the possibility of a chemical abnormality in the brain that makes someone more vulnerable, and all the things that conceivably may have fueled depression from what happens to the patient, from their worries, from their limitations in coping, and so forth.
So you're talking about a combination of medication and other kinds of
and
therapy,
and even before prescribing treatment, even the understanding of someone's presentation is best to allow for consideration of all the factors. Mind you, we live in Rochester, the home of the so-called biopsychosocial model in medicine, which stress is just that illness in general, not just mental illness, is the combined result of both external factors and physical vulnerability. And depression is a very good example of that. So when we see a patient with depression, we do not spend too much time trying to assign them to a category. We actually consider that everything could have led to depression, and that's why when it comes to treatment, combined treatments are thought to be more effective than treatment stressing only therapy or only medication.
You're listening to Healthy Friday. We're talking with Dr. Adrian Leibovich, the Chief of Psychiatry at Rochester General Health System, and we are talking about depression and other kinds of mental health issues, particularly bipolar disorder, in the wake of the death of Robin Williams earlier this week. Dr. Leibovich, let's talk a little bit about treatment. You're saying that the biopsychosocial model that looks at just about every kind of factor in a person's life that can contribute, in this case, we're talking about a mental health issues such as depression. Are you likely as a patient to go in and receive a diagnosis? I'm going to say probably without some kind of a test. You're probably not going to get an MRI or a CAT scan or a blood test for this. This is going to be diagnosed basically after hearing the presentation and the history of the patient. Is that accurate?
It's accurate. Most of the time, the diagnosis of depression is a clinical diagnosis. The presentation is important. The history is even more important. Combining those two allows a professional to make a diagnosis. In cases where the depression is severe and there are physical signs associated, it's not uncommon to want to do what we call an organic workup. There are medical conditions that can mimic depression very well. Obviously, you want to rule out anything that would be corrected differently than through psychiatric treatment.
Are there medical conditions or issues that could cause depression? Do you also look for other health problems or medications that might be causing the mental state?
Absolutely. There are a number of medications, some of them commonly used, like some medications used for high blood pressure, that are associated with depression, or steroids. There are medical conditions, again, some of them common, like thyroid disease, like some lack of vitamins, like certain cancers of the digestive system who evolve with depression. So a good inventory of medical problems and a good medical evaluation many times is an important first step before concentrating on other issues.
Over the years, there's been a lot of media coverage and a lot in the news and in science about antidepressants and about medications for depression. What is the most common most common treatment these days? What kinds of medications?
One of the positive things over the last 20, 30 years is that depression has become more and more the realm of the activity of primary care physicians. What helped was that we have a new generation of antidepressant medications that are easier to use, have fewer side effects, and primary care physicians are more comfortable using them. So it's not uncommon that someone who sees their primary care physician for depression will receive an empirical trial with one of the common antidepressants. Everybody hears about Prozac and Zoloft and Paxil and alike. And sometimes it's good enough.
How do you feel about that, about the stepping in of primary care? You're a specialist. Do you think that's wise?
I think it's great. I don't think that you can grow enough psychiatrists in numbers to satisfy the need for treatment. I think many times primary care physician alone or with the help of a consulting mental health professional can provide very decent and effective service for a large number of patients with depression. It's just as effective, and it keeps the cost of services down on one hand. On the other hand, there are cases where a specialist is needed, and there are other cases where the services of a therapist are also important.
All right, Dr. Leibovich, there's a lot in the media about depression. So not Robin Williams' death brought it to light this week, but other celebrities have talked about this. Catherine Zeta-Jones talked about her struggle with bipolar. The actor John Hamm talked about his struggle with depression after his father died. I wonder how you feel about just the regular people that are out there that are struggling with this. I understand that celebrities can shine a light in terms of awareness, but there's been some grousing on some blogs this week about the fact that there are so many people that are struggling and they're not getting the attention that they need.
There is still a shortage of providers on one hand, and there is still reluctance and fear in addressing these things. We come from a different generation where talking about how you feel and complaining about emotional issues was equated with weakness. And while we've made progress, there is still some difficulty with accessing care that way.